Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host Gwen Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Christopher Black. Each week we visit with authors, editors or publishers who have regional or local connections. We hope to find out a little about their lives, what prompts them to write, give them an opportunity to read some of their work for us. We're very pleased to have Christopher Black with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Christopher Black is an international criminal lawyer and writer. His family immigrated to Canada when he was 8 years old. He attended university in Hamilton and then Toronto. He spent 30 years as a trial lawyer in Toronto, except for 7 years in the mid-80s, when he dropped out to study acting and formed his own theatre company, Theatre Dynamics. When the money ran out, he returned to criminal law. For the past 16 years, he spent most of his time in Europe and Africa defending generals and presidents accused of war crimes. Since 2015, he's lived in Campbellford. Throughout his legal career, he has kept writing and has succeeded in publishing in many genres over the years. Welcome, Chris.
Oh, it's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
So let's fill out your brief biography a bit. Tell us about the many genres you've published in over the years.
Well, I began writing poetry when I was in high school, and I had a teacher that encouraged me there. But I didn't start writing pieces that got published until the 1990s, when I finished law school and began practicing law. And I had some pieces published in the Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail, op-eds about different social issues. And the editors liked them and asked me to write more and encouraged me to write. But then I found the law was too intensive and took up too much of my time, and it was too much stress to write.
Mm.
When I had breaks, I tried to, and I've got notebooks full of fragments of poems and novels and short stories, but nothing I really like now, looking back on it. But I thought they were great at the time.
Well, that's okay. To allow to enjoy what we're doing rather than what we've done. So you said you started out in life wanting to be a poet, but mm-hmm. then turned to psychology and thereafter the law. So how did this come about? Once you became a lawyer, was most of your writing professional? And I guess it was.
Hamilton, where I grew up, working class family, and Hamilton was a steel mill town, and either you went to work in the steel mills or you got out. And I was lucky to get into university. And I became interested in psychology for various reasons, but one of them was to understand how people think and work and behave. And that would help with my writing, I thought. And I liked it. And then I got accepted into a PhD program at the University of Edinburgh, but I couldn't afford to go. And I had applied to law school at the same time, because I thought I should have another avenue to go to, and I got accepted. So I went to law school and hated it.
Oh, did you?
And I left. I left it after the first 6 months. I quit. I went to my father and said, I don't like this. I'm leaving. And he said, you've got one of two choices. You go back or you go to the steel mills. And I said, well, I want to write. He says, good luck with that. So I went back to law school, and I liked the last couple of years, and then began doing trial work. And I liked doing trial work. I'm a very bad lawyer for office work. I hate actually working with words as a lawyer because it's just too detailed. But I like standing up and talking a lot. So I like the trial work. And most criminal lawyers I've met are deep down poets. I think all criminal lawyers are really poets or artists of some sort.
Actors?
You have to be an actress too, yeah. Which led me to the acting as well. Because I was also involved in acting during high school and university, amateur, and did quite a few plays.
So what was so attractive about it that you dropped the law and went and my
first 8 years as a lawyer was doing civil litigation, and I really didn't like it, and I was working for corporations, which I didn't feel I was doing anything for the world. I thought I was just making rich people richer and more powerful people more powerful. And it got to me. I got depressed, and I just dropped out. And I decided to try and do something else. I went to acting school. I studied at Tony Pierce in Toronto and Louise Nolan at the New School of Drama for 3 years. And we did a lot of plays, and I set up a theater company with some friends and Theater Dynamics. We did some David Hare plays, Christopher Lambton, Lee Blessing. Usually plays with two or three characters we could afford to produce in a small theater.
Mm-hmm.
That lasted about 7 years, and then I ran out of money, and I was trying to survive all the time. Somebody offered me a murder trial. I couldn't refuse, and I got sucked right back into the law. And I lost my agent, so I ended up being a lawyer again. And you'll find that many lawyers, they say in the United States, 90% of lawyers spend 100% of their time trying to get out of law, but you can't escape it. So that was me.
I see. So the plays and scripts you produced have disappeared into the past, have they?
I have a few pieces of scripts. I started writing a play 2 years ago, but I abandoned it because I don't know how it could ever be produced because it would be quite controversial. It's called The Trial of General Dallaire, and the title itself will startle people.
Yes,
what do you mean, The Trial of General Dallaire? Mm. But it was, I suppose, influenced by the Andersonville trial. I forget who wrote that now. A very famous trial in the United States about Civil War crimes committed in a prison camp. And I wanted to base it on that trial.
Mm.
It was a very good play, but I haven't gone further with it.
So why do you write now, Chris? Who are you writing for these days?
Sometimes I think I'm just writing for myself because there's a lot of things in my mind I want to get out or express in some way. And I find when I write, it's as I'm talking to another part of myself in a way. And things come out of my mind which I'm surprised are there. And I'm discovering things about myself as I write, which always surprise me. When I sit down with a blank piece of paper and I'm not sure where I'm going and I let myself go, somewhere else in my mind or another person in my mind comes out and starts talking. And that always pleasantly surprises me usually. I'm surprised what I come out with. But I'm also trying to...
Is that what happens when you write poetry too? Or is it different? And are you writing for a different audience with poetry?
Some poetry, I'm trying to make a statement. If it's a political poem, I'm usually trying to make a statement to people generally about how I see the world
mm-hmm.
and how I think they should see the world. With more personal pieces, I think it's more of myself talking to myself and getting out something I need to get out. And I feel better once I've done them. And there are pieces I go back to now and read, and I get satisfied from certain memories that come to me when I'm reading my own work and images I have of people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's satisfying psychologically and keeps my morale up. But I think I also like just playing with words. One of the joys of writing for me is I'll start writing a poem, and I have a line, and I have an idea, and I write down. And then when I start going back over it, I don't like the lines, and I start jiggling them around and changing them, and it transforms into something totally different. And
right.
And not one word stays the same, and I end up with a totally different poem.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that's what my mind was really trying to say.
Yeah.
So once I write something out, then let myself not judge myself, I come out with something different,
mm-hmm.
and usually better.
Oh, I'm sure. Okay, well, would you like to read us some of your poetry?
Sure, I'll read you something. A lot of my poetry I find is a bit dark and depressing, but I decided to read one also a bit depressing in a way, but it's funny, I think. It's based on what's going on with the climate these days and all the catastrophes we're reading about. It's called Diary's Last Entry. The rains came heavy that early spring, each day damper than the last. And the sun swallowed by sullen clouds, the birds bedraggled in the trees. It got to you after a while. All the dogs fretted and whined, and the people who walked them tugged through puddles as the grass grew tall and the trees shot up, dressed in a deep green never seen before. Branches extending, sap running, roots rooting, though the mare didn't seem to care or notice, the gardeners huddled, sharing their whispers. There were some who claimed to like it, you know, the ones who see the bright side of things of war and death and every cloud and all the other expressions of cluttered minds. That is, until no one could remember it not raining or ever seeing those flowers, those shapes, so alive. It gave you the shivers to see them, but their perfume. Women wore them in their hair and love bloomed. Well, men turned their heads and the women noticed. though some took offense, those afraid of themselves, and the press stopped mentioning the daily floods, the sightings of Tennessee possums near northern creeks, the news of distant fires in the west in far-off lands. And they didn't mention at first those black seeds that began to fall with every rain and every drop, just a meteorological phenomenon, one of nature's quirks, dragged up by the sweeping hand of high winds from ancient swamps, to fall like a dark manna on the life below. But then from the seeds came the vines, and from the vines the sounds, those vibrations and hums that filled the air, as the rains began to stop and the heat came on, and with the heat the vines began to climb, first the trees, then the walls, like snakes over sand, then to cover ground like eels twisting in the sea. At first people made jokes about them, about horror films that made them feel better as the days got warmer and they spread. They spread everywhere, vines as thick as your arm with big green leaves, as big as a man's hand at first, then bigger. And how they moved. Botanists had a field day trying to explain how they did it, moving around, not being connected to the earth. They invented names for it, put together theories, but they all walked around looking puzzled a lot. The far right wanted research on how to use them as biological weapons. The communists organized protests, but no one came. It was too hot, or it was too wet. Who could move? Who wanted to? But finally, the government organized anti-vine teams, flamethrowers for the bigger ones, chemicals on the rest, exterminating them, as we do with all things, or that was the plan. Until one day, old man Johnson, with a vine in his room, as a pet, felt more than heard the distinct sound of two modulating hums, hums exchanged between plant and machine, each responding to each, and reported it to the police, but their cars refused to move. Old man Johnson was no more when police arrived on foot later and found some blood and the vine and a computer laughing. The sergeant ordered his men to retreat. People panicked, systems failed, chaos grew, hunger set in, as the machines served them, not us, and their hunger grew. Some tried to resist, but it was too late. They were too few. They were too weak, too scared to win, to survive. And the seeps kept falling, and the rains kept coming, and the heat, what could be done in that heat?
Well, I don't know that it's funny, but it's certainly surprising. I like it.
Yeah, it was a sort of black humor, horror.
Thank you so much, Chris.
You're welcome.
Now we'll take a short break.